Welcome to A State of Mind. This is Julian Royce. I am so happy to bring you a new episode of this podcast, which is part of my desire to bring you the highest quality, cutting-edge information and conversations to help you on your journey of greater health, greater wellness, greater sense of connection in service of us all co-creating this more beautiful world that our hearts know is possible. To quote the memorable phrase from the writer Charles Eisenstein, I work here as a trauma-informed therapist, a meditation teacher. I offer psychedelic-assisted therapy, couples work, and more. You can find more out about that at astateofmindcounseling.org. I also play music, I play guitar, I DJ. I'm going to link my SoundCloud link below. Check that out there. And I'm also going to link my Instagram account, where I have been more active lately. I've been sharing videos related to health, wellness, mental health, as well as my life in general. If you're finding value in this podcast, please support us. You can do that directly on our Patreon page linked below. You can also do that by giving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Especially Spotify podcasts, I've been reaching out to folks asking, hey, if you're listening to this on Spotify, please give us a good review. Another great way to support this podcast is sharing about it on your own social media account or just sharing it with friends and family. Today, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Harvey Schwartz. Harvey is a psychologist who specializes in treating complex PTSD, dissociative disorders, as well as patients with spiritual and therapy-related trauma. And he has undergone advanced ketamine-assisted therapy training through the Ketamine Training Center. He's now a teacher of teachers. He's teaching and training the next generation of psychedelic-assisted therapists. And he was a supervisor and trainer on the MAPS MDMA-assisted therapy clinical trials, MAPS standing for the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Science. These are the cutting-edge trials specifically with MDMA that have helped push the movement forward in terms of making psychedelics legal, of having scientific, like really authentic scientific studies that validate them and show how effective they are in treating things like PTSD. This is one of my favorite podcast conversations of all time. I really appreciated re-listening to it and preparing to get it published. I learned a lot from it. I would recommend this episode to fellow therapists, to students studying psychology, and to anyone who is interested in a deeper understanding of PTSD, of disassociation, and who's interested in the paradigm shift that psychedelic medicine is offering our culture at this time. Without further ado, I bring you Dr. Harvey Schwartz. Today with Harvey Schwartz. Harvey, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I'm really excited to talk with you. And I came to know of you through being a participant in the workshop you did at the MAPS conference here in Denver last summer, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Science. And there were 2 days before the conference started of workshops and learning, and you led the advanced MDMA assisted therapy workshop, which was such a treat to get to be there and see everyone and learn and hear about your experiences with the MAP studies and with your work there. And
Yeah, I got to co-lead that particular workshop for the first time with two of my mentors. So for me, it was a real beautiful opportunity because Bruce and Marcella had been doing that work much longer than I had. And in different ways, they had been my mentors as I was part of the first group of therapists trained. And Bruce was my mentor as I became a supervisor and mentor supervisor. So it was the first time I got to train with them as equals. So it was a beautiful opportunity to teach with my teachers, if you know what I mean.
So it's, beautiful. Yeah. So they were helping teach you about it when you got into
when I first got into it, yeah.
And you were one of the therapists in the room with a patient with the MDMA trials with MAPS. Is that right?
Yeah, so I was part of the first group of about 30 or 40 of us that were trained by the initial 3 or 4 people who were doing most of the research. Marcella Otalara, Bruce Bolter, and Michael Methoffer and Annie Methoffer. So those are the 4 original people who did almost all the original phase 1 and phase 2 research. Then I was part of the first group of about 35 of us who were trained, and most of us have gone on to do all the phase 2, phase 3 research. Most of us grew up to become the next, level of supervisors and trainers and educators, and so we're sort of the next generation after them to take it forward.
Beautiful, and specifically with the MAPS organization.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Which has now changed its name to Lycos, as you know. became a different organization.
Oh, okay. Can you share that with us? I'm not totally up on that.
Yeah, it's probably more complicated than I want to get into right now, if that's okay. But the organization changed and is in the process of a transformation in name and in structure. But I think the spirit of trying to move MDMA therapy into the world remains the same.
And it's called Lykos?
L-Y-K-O-S. Yeah.
Okay.
And everything's in a state of reforming because, all of the data has been handed into the FDA. Mm. And all the government agencies. And so it takes about 9 months for them to review everything. And everybody's kind of waiting for probably August or September when hopefully they will officially reschedule MDMA. And we don't know whether they will reschedule it at all or if they will to schedule two or schedule three. And from there, the medicine will be rolled out in a variety of ways to clinics and practices around the country where people have been trained to do the work.
Beautiful. It's so exciting. Yeah. So here in Colorado, we're waiting. It's going to happen pretty soon where there'll be legislative guidelines for psilocybin assisted therapy. And part of that initiative that was passed here means that people will be able to access psilocybin without a therapist. They'll be able to have a choice. And that was an effort to make it more accessible, I think was the intention there. So, but obviously the FDA is the federal level, and that'll be a huge deal when that happens. It seems. How confident are you that that's going to happen?
The data have been so powerful and positive for the past 20 years, and so much effort has gone into it, and there's such profound need. And I think there's a strange collaboration between right-wing and left-wing people around the country around the issue of mental health and PTSD. And so I think because of that unusual shared mission, which in our country right now is very rare that Republicans, Democrats would agree about anything, I think it's likely that it will move forward.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's such a good point that this is one issue where there's been cooperation with people of different political stripes. And that is a rarity. And that's really cool to see. And I think it makes a lot of sense. And I had a ketamine assisted therapist on the podcast who shared how helpful that's been with depression, you know, in case studies where someone was actively suicidal and ketamine assisted therapy shifted that for them. And that should 100% be a bipartisan thing, right? No one wants suicide. We want the opposite of that. And so,
well, all mental health should be a bipartisan issue.
Yes. Yeah.
So yeah. Ketamine has particular, well, ketamine is a very complicated medicine that has a diverse array of uses. And it's particularly known for and particularly mysteriously powerful for anti-suicidality more than any of the other psychedelic medicines. It has many other uses. But because of that, you know, people who are in a very acute state of suicidality come into an emergency room or some other place. And, you know, between 1 and 7 days, there can be a transient alleviation of acute suicidality, which means that in that 1 to 7 days, not only can lives be saved, but the beginning of a therapeutic process could be started, you know, such that, you know, when that initial wave wore off, there could be further use of the medicine, but also somebody may get over the hump that led them to want to commit suicide and thereby engage in treatment. And so it's many uses for ketamine, but that's one of the most important mental health emergency uses now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's well said. And that metaphor of getting over the hump, I think, is accurate. And that's what we want, especially when it's acute. So,
right. There's many, many people are in dark nights of the soul, alone and confused or lost for different reasons. And there hasn't really been anything really nurturing and supportive aside from, you know, hospitalizations, which can sometimes be very traumatic for people. And so the fact that there is a medicine that can be injected that can kind of ease the acuteness of that particular existential psychological suffering to leave room for the next phase of healing or perspective shifts for that person is one of the kind of major miracles with ketamine, especially given that, you know, that medicine was not developed for that reason. Ketamine was developed as an for help in surgery with anesthesia because it's particularly safe for respiratory issues and anesthesia. So it was not at all developed with mental health in mind. And then without getting into the full history of ketamine, subsequent, observations of patients led to its becoming understood to have psychedelic as antidepressant, anxiolytic properties, and anti-suicidal properties. So it's one of those mysteries of medicine where something that's developed for one reason, suddenly over time becomes observed to have all these other effects, called off-label in the professional world, off-label use, off-label effects.
Interesting. Yeah. And that led to it being discovered as its treatment for depression in part, right?
And then ultimately treatment as a psychedelic, even though it's a non-traditional psychedelic, it's called a dissociative psychedelic or dissociative anesthetic. When medical professionals started observing what was called the emergence phenomena, I don't know if you've heard of that term, but that's the term that was initially used, emergence phenomena, probably back in the 60s and 70s when people in the hospital were noticing that patients on ketamine were coming out of their surgery, and the surgery could have been for their ankle or for their knee, with these reports of very profound, sometimes disturbing, but often beautiful, magical, spiritual experiences, psychedelic experiences. And so it was like, oh, this medicine can be used for that. And then there became a bifurcation in the field where some medical folks thought this was a problem. We better get rid of this. We have to sort of keep the beneficial uses of ketamine, the anesthetic use, the safe anesthetic uses, and get rid of the emergence phenomena. And psychedelic therapists or transformationally oriented folks or people used to working with non-ordinary states of consciousness said, hey, aha, here it is, another medicine that can be used for transformational work in depth-oriented psychotherapy. So that's what happened with the emergence phenomenon, two different, you know, paths of our culture. You know, one went for biological safety and suppression, and the other went for optimization of this potential.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I think it's fascinating how the kind of history of our culture and science and the role psychedelics is playing there. Our culture was so materialistic, and with like behavioralism, you know, in the world of psychology, we were really denying the subjective experience like altogether in a way that when you look back on it, it's weird. But I think psychedelics have been part of, hey, let's honor our subjective experience. Let's honor what could be called spirituality. Let's honor these other parts. And there's actually value there, of course. And
Yeah, well, in some ways, you know, the psychedelic movement, you know, reconnected us with the wisdom of indigenous cultures, practices, which had been going on for thousands and thousands of years. One of the reasons why I think sometimes we hesitate to call it the psychedelic renaissance is because in some ways it disregards the fact that many indigenous cultures, both with and without plant medicines, but using non-ordinary states of consciousness as the primary vehicle of healing and community. So the combination of community and non-ordinary states of consciousness have been around for so long that psychedelics entered our culture from a variety of pathways, but one, you know, was from the Mazatec tradition of Maria Sabina. And so, you know, we have to remember that this was going on long before Western folks discovered psychedelics as a new medium for transformation and for expediting the healing, and also for what would we call treatment-resistant conditions. In other words, things that nothing else could treat, it would seem like different psychedelics are able to have an effect where nothing else could have an effect. And that being said, not always, not 100% of the time, but with greater frequency and regularity than any other medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating history. And I've learned that you had a long career with psychology, helping people before you got involved with psychedelics. Do you want to share about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Of course, I always had an interest in the intersection of spirituality, mysticism, transformation, psychotherapy, and healing. So that I kind of started that way as a young guy. But my first career was working with complex PTSD and severe dissociative identity disorder conditions, which only began to be studied and discovered really in earnest in the 80s. And so most of the population that I worked with and then began to teach about were victims of very complex and extreme, often bizarre and horrific forms of torture, trauma, and multiple perpetrator abuse and violation in collective situations such as cults or criminal organizations or trafficking systems, child prostitution, child pornography systems, and other kinds of paramilitary organizations and gangs. So there's a whole population of people that our society really didn't know much about, whose voices had never been heard were only kind of beginning to come out of the woodwork in the 80s. Remember, PTSD was not a diagnosis until 1980. So the legitimization of the diagnosis of PTSD in 1980 changed everything. Mm. Because before 1980, not only were voices suppressed, but people with, not to get into a whole history of PTSD, that's one of my big teaching topic areas, but just to say briefly, this means that everybody before 1980 who had any condition related to trauma and PTSD, and we're talking about millions of people on the planet, were misdiagnosed and given other medications, given false diagnoses, given inappropriate diagnoses. Once PTSD became a legitimate diagnosis in 1980, many people began to be recognized for having something other than, you know, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or depression. And that meant our society opened the door for stories to be told and for people to be validated and for people to speak about what happened to them in ways that they never could before. And many things followed upon that. But that's so that my career started at that point. I got my PhD in 1982. Mm. And ironically enough, just to say, when I teach this, I always say the word trauma and DID were never mentioned once in my 5 years of graduate school training. Oh. And I became a specialist in something that I never learned one sentence about in graduate school, which is just to say we continue learning after we're in school.
Yes.
And sometimes we learn more on our own and learn more from our patients than we do from anything we learn in school. So my career ended up, you know, accidentally entering in this field while it was just booming in the middle of the 1980s. And yeah, all these survivors started to come through telling us about forms of violence going on that nobody really was tracking.
Well, it's, it's in the shadow. People don't want to look at it because it's hard to look at, but good for you for doing that work. And you had some intuition that, hey, trauma is important, and you followed that. It sounds like now it's such a big part of my world and the work I do. It's amazing to remember the history that before 1980, that wasn't an official diagnosis. People were debating, is trauma or PTSD a real thing? That really says something about our culture and the evolution of our culture too, right?
Definitely. And so it's ironic, especially for younger people like you. Whenever I teach trauma, I always teach, let's remember the history because you're also used to it. Like trauma is so ubiquitous. It's mentioned every day. There's so many people teaching and training, but it's only been, you know, 44 years since the legitimization of that diagnosis. And even then it took a long time for it to be recognized and for people to be trained in how to work with it. And we're still learning so many new things about the biology of trauma, the neurobiology of trauma, and moving out of like just verbal forms of therapy into all forms of, movement and, you know, the somatic therapies and different ways to access the unconscious. And of course the psychedelic therapy wave coming in now to begin to, you know, add a huge armamentarium I hate the word tools, but you know, of mediums through which we can help people heal not only rapidly but more deeply than some of the other methods that are available. That's how I joined sort of the psychedelic movement, crossing over from what I had been doing to finding out about MAPS, which I had not heard of, doing work with MDMA for treatment, quote unquote, treatment resistant PTSD, and I saw a great opportunity for me to combine all my interests in one particular field. So I kind of moved over there and have been mostly in that work ever since 2016.
Yeah. Yeah. If we could just go into this point a little bit more around the history of trauma as a diagnosis, it is so much the water I swim in. It's almost hard to imagine becoming a therapist, getting into mental health, studying issues without an understanding of trauma. I know that in World War I, there were soldiers that were shell-shocked, you know, quote unquote, and there was some recognition that an experience like war could have mental health consequences afterwards. It seems so obvious today. Do you have anything to share just about that history or how that developed?
I have more to share than you have time for. It's one of the things I teach a lot about. But in a brief sense, you know, there were words for people's traumatic experiences, combat fatigue, war neurosis, shell shock. And then for women who had been subjected to rape or child abuse, or men who'd been subject to child abuse, the language that was used before 1980 did not have the word trauma in it. And so there was a lot of talk about people's fantasy or something wrong with them. And so even veterans who were diagnosed, there was a sign that there's something wrong with them, that they went through this and didn't recover. And so there was a pathologizing and a shaming of all people who had been trauma survivors. And the word trauma survivor wasn't even a term. And so what millions of people around the world experienced, and still do in some areas, was a kind of misdiagnosis, a shaming, a naming, a shaming, a blaming, and almost as if, because not everybody who went through these experiences seems to be having severe symptoms, there must be something wrong with you for having it. And there was no knowledge of trauma whatsoever. There was just no understanding of it. And then really Judith Herman's book, probably in 1992, Trauma and Recovery, which is probably mandatory reading now in almost every graduate program, outlines the basic beginning of bringing, sophisticated trauma theory into the mainstream mental health world. But even in the 80s, there really, wasn't, such a large compendium of work. The idea that the individual was blamed for their problem and that the societal conditions that caused it were never included in the meant that all survivors of trauma were now having a double or triple trauma. What they went through, how it was misperceived, how it was misdiagnosed, and now they were shamed and blamed for what they went through. So the probability that any of them would get any healing and the probability that any of their stories would be told was highly likely before 1980.
It's an amazing history and a tragic one. I know we don't want to spend a ton of time on it, but any thoughts to share with us about just the development, the evolution, so to speak, of our culture, the reasons why there was so much resistance to understanding this, which seems so obvious to us today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. I think Judith Herman articulates it really well in her book, her classic book. She talks about the pendulum that swings around societal recognition of trauma. Then it goes from periods of like open and awareness through periods of backlash and shutdown. And if we study the individual person, like the individual trauma survivor, they too always experience an inner fluctuation between acknowledging, admitting, and recognizing the trauma and shutting it down, covering it up, and going back underground. And so every individual goes through this cycle. And she identified it was a collective, universal, ubiquitous problem for societies. And so we have this strange kind of parallel process between the individual trying to work their way out of PTSD and the collective going through periods of not wanting to know that this happened. Because once you know what's going on, you are now confronted with so many challenges to face, existential, spiritual challenges about what humans are capable of or what happened in your family that you might not have faced. And so, the revelation of trauma is a shattering of people's previously held belief systems or ideals or religious beliefs. We have to remember that a large portion of the American public does not believe the Holocaust happens. We are already having, right? So we already are seeing the backlash around, historic events that have massive documentation. And so I just think it's some bizarre human phenomena around the inability to integrate shadow and light about the human experience itself. And the danger, of course, is that history will repeat itself until humanity can hold shadow and light together about ourselves, what we're capable of, and take responsibility for cleaning up the messes we made, whether it's environmental or psychological or economic. We're going to continue to go through fluctuations of, revelation and then suppression, revelation and then suppression. So it seems to be built into the fabric of the human condition.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's so interesting to make these connections between the individual journey and the societal. And there's clearly a lot there. Good to make the distinction too. They're not the same, of course, but yeah, so much of my work with clients will often be if there's some belief or sense of there's something wrong with me, whether it's my fault or that shame or blame or guilt, and how to heal that, how to change that belief and perspective. And
that's the hardest part of trauma work, right? Because that belief is inculcated by the society, by almost all perpetrators, and children underneath the age of, let's say children beneath the age of 8 or 10, because of, what you know about developmental psychology, right? The cognitive capacity for children to make sense of the world, pretty much before the age of 8 or 10 is only kind of an egocentric ability to say, this was my fault, I caused it, or I'm the reason why something happened. So if children by their very nature can only understand negative experiences that happen by virtue of their limited cognition as I must have caused it, I must have done something wrong, something was wrong with me, and the people who are harming them are saying that to them, And when they try to reveal it to somebody, they get shut down. And the society has been shaming and blaming trauma survivors for decades. You can see that there's like compound multiple forces that are reinforcing somebody's belief that they caused it. And so when something's embedded that deeply in the unconscious, regular verbal psychotherapy doesn't usually access the deeply held somatic and unconscious belief that I cause it, I'm awful, I made it happen, there's something wrong with me. But psychedelics, and this is where the drum roll for psychedelics, you know, not that they're the magic pill or the magic bullet, but they seem to have the power to bring connection between the conscious and unconscious and between the spirit or mysterious, interdimensional, whatever word you want to use, the phenomenological world, the mystical world, the spiritual world, and connect these things that had been previously disconnected, and with therapists who know how to steward this work such that embedded belief systems can get broken apart and accessed and released in a way through the body and through relationship in a way that very few other medicines can do. And remember that most of our medicines are suppressive in nature, right? They kind of suppress symptoms or soften symptoms. That's mostly what Western pharmaceuticals are all about. But the psychedelic therapy movement is all about evoking, revealing, and tracking and processing, right? They actually facilitate processing. They don't suppress symptoms. And so this is a huge paradigm shift in mental health. And Scott Shannon, who's a neighbor of yours in Colorado, has written a beautiful article called Ketamine, A Catalyst for a Paradigm Shift in Mental Health, in a recent article, and a beautiful, beautiful paper he wrote describing this shift in mental health itself that psychedelics and particularly ketamine bring from a suppressive, symptom-oriented to an evocative, kind of evolving, releasing, healing, transformational view of mental health. And it's a radical shift going on in our field right now.
I love that. That's so important. I think that's a great perspective to share and part of the power and promise of psychedelic therapy. And that's a huge difference between suppressing and you actually evoking, actually going into the difficulty, the pain, so that it can be healed on a deeper level instead of trying to manage the symptoms.
But remember, and this gets into the complexity of economics, right? Our complete, let's say the pharmaceutical industrial complex and the medical system and all the doctors being trained are oriented towards mollifying, medicating symptoms and symptom relief and symptom suppression. And now we have this whole new movement, right? That's really not new at all, because indigenous medicine has always used this idea of evoking, releasing, accessing, and communal holding of the individual. So now we have this new model, and I think the models are in collision right now. And they're in collision philosophically, they're in collision in different fields, psychology, medicine, but they're also going to be in collision in terms of the financial realities of, you know, an old system based on suppression and taking a pill every day versus a new system based on not having to take a pill very often, but, you know, creating a relationally safe, secure space for people to actually go so deep into themselves that they can, what I would say, find the shrapnel of trauma and release it. And the main shrapnel of trauma that got you and I into this, by the way, was shrapnel such as, I caused this, I made it happen, I'm bad, and deep feelings of shame and unworthiness that all trauma survivors feel because of all the compound influences that make that happen. And so verbal, regular psychotherapy is hard to reach something, you know, even if somebody knows, I know I didn't cause it, I know I'm a good person, but deep down embedded, there's still a holding pattern. And psychedelics loosen up that holding pattern in a really interesting way, neurobiologically, emotionally, when done in a context of a really safe, secure, wise psychotherapy. And so no longer does the person feel held hostage to these unconscious pieces of shrapnel from their trauma, because they themselves are connected to their own healing, inner healing intelligence, not just the authority of the therapist or the authority of a drug. And they themselves begin to work out a deeper truth about who they really are, not just defined by the trauma, who they are spiritually. And suddenly these very deeply held beliefs begin to become no longer like the dominating force in their psychic lives. There may be a period where the old beliefs and the new beliefs battle it out. Do you know what I mean? Like after a session, you can have a big revelation of a new perspective. And sometimes the old goes back and forth for a while with the new, but at least the like very embedded old belief or feeling or trauma memory or secret or is coming out from its kind of being held stuck in the psyche.
Yeah, that's so well said. It's so important to share that with people. You're really doing a good job of putting it in this bigger context and understanding the power and potential of psychedelic healing. And that paradigm shift is huge. I think that's inspiring to hear about. I think there is a kind of battle. I think there's a place for pharmaceuticals, of course, and antidepressants and all that. But the paradigm, the underlying understanding of what mental health means, of what health means, you know, I don't even like to talk about mental health per se, because it sounds like it's something different than health per se. It's like, it's just health and wellness and healing. And I think we're a little bit too divided at times with all the categories of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all those categories have pejorative aspects of them. If we say mental well-being, we have the word being, well-being. And so we're already defining a person as a being, and creating a space for them to be treated as something more than an object. And without getting into this, we can go down many side roads because of what we're talking about. Yeah. But the side road I want to just mention is the way in which, you know, millions of people have been treated like objects in the medical and mental health system, and the way people have been trained, unfortunately, in medical school and other schools to look at human beings as objects to be technically worked on and chemicals to be put into them to control them, to mollify symptoms, and human subjectivity, human spirituality, the essence of humanity, existential, spiritual, phenomenological elements of a human being have not ever been fully take it into account in Western medicine. And so now the psychedelic movement is coming in and pushing things in this other direction. And it's, it encounters many obstacles, right? In the 60s, it encountered many obstacles because the liberatory potential that LSD had in the 60s on our society was radical. Remember, 4 million people had done LSD by 1969.
Wow.
Do you realize what that means? 4 million people by 1969 had done LSD. So, you know, the cat got out of the bag, so to speak. And I believe, and many other people believe, that many of the transformations we began to see in our society were fueled by this injection of this kind of, you know, massive access to non-ordinary states of consciousness in a society where people had no previous stewardship or access to that. And of course, we didn't exactly know what to do with it because there were no elders or no, you know, wise ones to hold it the way indigenous cultures have for thousands of years. There's always people who hold those traditions. And so things went a bit haywire. And then also the politics came in because, you know, the government or the powers that be did not want to see revolution happen. So all these medicines were used as a political weapon against, people of color and against political left-leaning people to suppress their access to, you know, public demonstrations and to make them enemies of the state, more or less, and using LSD and using other drugs to categorize people as enemies of the state and to propagandize this to the media. And so we had this horrible backlash and lost like 40 years of research and training and practice because of Richard Nixon's rescheduling of all these medicines as a political act to suppress, under the guise of protecting the people, you know, under the guise of protecting America from drugs, actually was a major assault on the Black and the politically leftist communities in America. And the damage, as you know, has been done because we have massive incarceration of African Americans in the United States and other people of color that are still a legacy of the use of the drug wars to under the guise of public protection, to incarcerate people and not heal them and not help them. And so we have so many decades to recover from. And so remember this, the new psychedelic movement, which everybody's excited about, is we have to remember our history, right? We're coming into a collision between the old paradigm and the new. And I think if we're not careful if we forget our history, this new movement could get swallowed up in the old paradigm.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Yeah, the history, it's heavy.
Really heavy.
I think one thing that came to my mind as you were sharing that was just how important having a good conceptual understanding actually is, having some sense of roadmap. And I can't really imagine what it would be like to take something like LSD with no idea or understanding of what it is. Like the people in the 60s, like it was so new and culturally it was completely new. But now, especially with in the context of healing and ceremonial work and psychedelic assisted therapy, to understand that you're entering this experience and why you're doing it, that's what the sun setting was about, of course. But that piece is so important, because however profound we're altering the experiences, then when you're coming back, you want to be able to make sense of it and integrate it with your life. And you need to have that kind of understanding and roadmaps to do that.
Yes, yes. And well, I agree like 90% of what you're saying, right? And I think generally the best way to do these medicines is with good preparation, good integration with people who are really trained. There's a political thing I want to just say that, you know, remember that, you know, because I used these medicines back then and with my friends who are all spiritual seekers, without, you know, the context before they were really becoming illegal in the way they became. And so that even without, you know, the best possible training that we have now, many, many people progressed on their spiritual path and on their own using their friends, like sort of like a sangha of friends who were exploring spiritual dimensions, exploring non-ordinary consciousness without the structure of any elders or medical establishment. And for the most part, we didn't have massive crises with psychedelic being used, you know, in the underground or being used by people. And so, although I do think they really do need to be best used in a conscientious, therapeutically well-trained way, it's also good to remember that the people took it in their own hands when these were not available. The miracle of, you know, millions of people doing LSD in the 60s was that people knew there was a truth. People were following on their own something that the government and our medical and psychotherapy institutions hadn't made available. So there's something about the revolutionary nature that humanity has that people are gonna find, even if things are banished or unavailable, there were still movements of people seeking. You know what I mean? I don't know if this is making sense to you.
And no, so that makes, totally makes sense. That's a really important point. And absolutely. And I think I fully support that and people to be able to make their own choices. And I think it's important. That was part of the initiative in Colorado, was decriminalizing psilocybin, but having a place for, and I think the language even mentions indigenous people in it. I forget exactly what it says, but that there can be guides and ceremonies that aren't in the medical establishment, that aren't trained therapists. And there should be a place for that. But I just think with part of the cost and negative impact of the war on drugs and Nixon and all that stuff was, it's almost like dropping dye in the collective water, where these substances and experiences can be seen through a negative light. And I think it's so important to undo that kind of conditioning. Like, of course, anything can be misused and there's, you know, we want to be very careful, but to have this, to advocate for like this view that they are medicines, they are healing, and we can, if we approach them in that way, it makes a difference, I guess is what I'm offering.
Definitely. Definitely. It's also important to remember. I wouldn't say sidetracked a little bit. I think the politics are important to remember, because things could replay again the same way in the future. And that is that, what was I going to say? That there was massive false advertising campaigns on TV that were lying to the American people, saying that people were jumping out of windows and there was chromosomal damage for people using LSD. These were blatant lies that were allowed to be used by the media. And so we have to remember that the medicines that are sacred that we're talking about have been so demonized, so misused, and certain communities, particularly communities of color, have been so brutally affected by the way in which these drugs, medicines, sacraments have been usurped to serve other agendas. Political, economic, social, oppressive agendas, that we really need to remember that as we go forward, and not be naive about the ways in which, you know, the very same medicine that could kind of help you realize how oppressed you have been in your family, in your culture, in your religion, or, you know, by virtue of, you know, persecution due to your sexual orientation or race, whatever, they can also be used as political tools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. We need to remember that.
Sorry to be so heavy, but It's always good to remember, because there's so much beauty and so much light and so much potential. And there's such a, you know, a hopeful moment right now. We're on the edge of possibly rescheduling MDMA and psilocybin in different states. Australia legalized things. You know, the dominoes will fall when America's policies, which has dominated all the world around drugs. So it's so hopeful. So many people with PTSD are going to get help. So many people. And so I don't in any way want to, taint the excitement I have about all the potential and all the healing I've seen in my own life with people. But the shadow is so intense around trauma and psychedelic medicines in the United States and in the world that we cannot forget the past. We're going to repeat it in some way. So that's why.
Absolutely. What you're saying is so important. And it's good to have that, more of that on this podcast, actually, because it's good to, good to be positive and look at, but to remember that history. And I really wish that we could have more of a national reckoning. I think there's been some efforts to release people from jail, but it seems like we could do a lot more there. There's still millions of people. I don't know all the numbers right now off the top of my head, but people in jail for, for example, marijuana possession, and now it's
exactly
half the country, and it's absurd. So why isn't there more of a movement to release them? I think it's
right.
A little bit, but not enough. Yeah.
And what does it say about our society that, let's just say, there's some 17 or 18 year old, usually a person of color in Mississippi with one marijuana cigarette that's in jail for 20 years, while millions of mostly white people are making millions of dollars in the marijuana industry. And how is that happening in the same country? How is that possible? But it is, right? There are many people in jail and then being traumatized in jail by, what goes on in jails. I used to work in prisons. Now being re-traumatized for that one marijuana cigarette, while marijuana millionaires now have huge ability to actually control the psychedelic world because of their money. So you can see the politics, the economics should never be forgotten, and the inequality of access to these medicines, and also the results of the war on drugs were not equally distributed among the population. Mm-hmm. They mostly have affected people of color, predominantly Black people, and impoverished or people who are underclassed, who didn't have legal representation or who didn't have access to, getting out of prison, the way a lot of upper middle class white people do, And so we really have to hold the shadow in light. And there's many there's many other shadows I won't get into today, but, as we have enthusiasm, if we don't hold the shadow, I feel like we are potentially, not taking responsible, we're not being responsible about the harm that has been done and the harm that still could be done, which gets into the whole other topic of like the training of therapists and the mistakes therapists are already making before psychedelics come in, and the boundary violations that happen on the, because my main commitment is the training of therapists. That's my main goal with my career, the training of psychedelic therapists, the next generation of therapists. And because one of my other specialties, aside from working with PTSD and DID, was working with survivors of therapy trauma.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that about you.
Yeah. So because I have that in my history, I know without psychedelics, what can happen. And it's already happened, both in the underground and above ground, when people have access to psychedelics, and therapists, for a variety of reasons, let's say there's many motivations, take advantage of or make mistakes and harm people while they're in psychedelic states. And so we also have, sorry that for some reason our conversations ended up bringing in a lot of the shadow, and I don't know if that's what you planned, but I just want to make sure we cover it.
I wasn't expecting to totally go here with you, but it's actually 100% welcome, and I think it's a really valuable thing for the podcast, because I've had a lot of therapists and researchers and people in the space, and there's a lot of excitement, and there's a lot of research, and we can make these more available, and you're really doing a good job of speaking to the history and the shadows and the heaviness of that, and yeah, I would love to hear. I mean,
how is it affecting you to hear all this from me? I'm just wondering.
Let me be authentic. There's a sense of heaviness, and I'm actually having a little bit of that experience that you spoke to earlier, where when something's traumatic, we don't want to look at it, and it's like, oh, I haven't faced some of this stuff in a while. And I try to do my part, and I'm well aware of the history. I love history, but there's, and I think this is actually can be a valuable part of human psychology. And I see to myself, like, it's good to be optimistic, and it's good to have an optimistic view towards the future. And But you're really calling us to like remember the past, and some of it's not even the past, but even that, mm-hmm. that negative shadow past war on drugs, mm-hmm. it's not that long ago. And there's people in jail right now, and their whole world was negatively impacted by events. I mean, obviously in Mississippi and places like that still going on, but 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, not that long ago. It's not that long ago at all.
Right, right. And the, you know, and the paradox also is something like this. So this has to do with what I call money, power, prestige, and privilege. Money, power, prestige, and privilege entering the psychedelic world. Hmm. Once upon a time, these medicines were banished, illegal, and demonized. Like 10 years ago, if somebody said they wanted to do research in most institutions in America on any of these things, they would have been laughed out of graduate school, and they would not have been allowed to do a study. Then fast forward, even until recently, so, you know, Veronica, Eric, and I, we founded Polaris Insight Center with a couple of other colleagues, and then we ended up becoming more of a training center, and our other colleagues moved on. And so just to give you an example of the games in our society, right, 4 years ago, Veronica and I submitted a one-hour talk, I won't say to what conference, on ketamine-assisted therapy. Completely rejected. Oh. Wanted no part of it. Hmm. Four years later, count how many universities around the country are now starting their own psychedelic centers, their own psychedelic clinics, their own psychedelic research centers. Whew. Why? What does that say? So the hypocrisy in our field never ceases to amaze me, you know?
Yeah.
And so now, because money, power, prestige, and privileges are pouring in to these universities, which are now filled with people who have no deep soulful connection to psychedelics, but they have money, power, prestige, so they're going to get all these grants. So now they want to have people come and talk. But it's not really coming from the same motivation that many of us who have been kind of involved in this work for a long time are holding as soul work and soul healing and kind of revolutionizing mental health. It's coming because there's money, power, prestige, and privilege coming into academic organizations.
Yeah, such a good point. I just got this book called The Status Game by Will Storr. He was on the Joe Rogan podcast recently, and what you're naming money, power, prestige, privilege, he calls status, I think. And he just explains so much of human behavior through our need for status, and we play these games, and the rules can shift really quickly. You know, when the Nazis mm-hmm. started to come to power in Germany, all of a sudden that was the status, and so people just shift. And maybe a similar analogy thing, like the cultural tides shift and all of a sudden, yeah, there's all the, it's just in the status game in part.
Yeah, really well put. So now psychedelics become high status. Before they were demonized or considered low status. And it's good for us to remember the game, right? Mm-hmm. To have a meta awareness of how things can shift and how the forces that are driving some of the forces that are driving the psychedelic movement are not so noble.
Yeah, that's the truth. Yeah, that's really good to name. Yeah, it's hard to, we're such a capitalistic society, so the money drives a lot of it, right? But I think the prestige part and the status part, maybe it's even more important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, on the other side of it, right? So maybe, and for better or worse, maybe it takes that for more people to get access. So the shadow of the shadow is light, right? Hmm. And so maybe the fact that, you know, now all these universities that once spat upon people 4 or 5 years ago, now that they're going to have research centers, there'll be more and more people, hopefully, who get access to these medicines. And maybe in human nature, that's just the way it has to go. So the good side of all that power, prestige, and privilege is that some university in Arkansas and Delaware will now be having psychedelic clinics and research so that people in those communities can get access to the medicines, because suddenly it became cool mm-hmm. for psychedelics to be something you study. So like, maybe okay, if that's the price. Yeah, even it. And I have a lot of wonderful colleagues in Mississippi and Alabama who are amazing, who are doing breakthrough work, bringing ketamine therapy into those communities against much more odds than we have in California. And so I want to bow to that. People are coming to train with us from the South, and they're bringing the medicine back, and they're doing amazing things in Alabama and Mississippi right now.
I like to have a perspective of development. You know, culturally we're moving, you know, idea of progress, and I know not everyone shares that, and there's a lot of evidence to not think that, but I like to think that we're moving forward and progressing, and this is a part of it. So
We're definitely moving forward and we're definitely progressing. And remember, human nature and human history always has a two steps forward, one step back. You know, it's always a, it's always paradoxical. And so whenever there's movement, there's something to undo the movement. And so if we hold awareness of that, I think we can stay on the course and become aware of this other pattern, which tries to like bring things back. For example, like one of the movements is, we joke and call it like Prozac 2.0 or 3.0, trying to turn psychedelic therapy into a pill. That some companies are trying to use the biochemistry knowledge we have about psychedelics to turn it into a new pill that you'll take every day. And I'm not even saying that's right or wrong, good or bad, but that will make people will be dependent on the pharmaceutical industry rather than coming for a psychotherapeutic process where they may take, you know, three or four of these medicines over a two-year period with a psychotherapist and do the kind of inner transformational healing that make them completely independent of the pharmaceutical industrial complex. And so there's two forces coming because there's money invested by many millionaires who want people to have a drug that they take every day so that they can make profit. And what about drugs that people only take 10 times in their lifetime? You see what I mean? So I think there's a real clash of motivations.
There's a tremendous economic pressure to create products like that, that you take consistently, that you have to subscribe to or keep ordering and keep taking. And yeah, you're right. One way I've seen that in the psychedelic space is microdosing, which I think can be great. I'm not saying anything against it, but you could, you know, if you're creating a pill, that's your little microdose pill, then you got to keep taking it. And that's, you know, so it's a kind of the similar model, perhaps, of the pharmaceutical model.
I guess it depends on who's who's distributing and controlling the microdosing medicine and what the research is on. Do you have to take it indefinitely or you just take it for periods of time? And, you know, what is the investment of those companies in giving back, for example, to indigenous cultures or to people who are suffering because of the wars on drugs? You know, what's also the motivation to give back? So I think it would be, you know, very specific to where they're coming from to be understood. But, you know what I mean? Like what the motivation of the people coming up with a microdose pill are.
That's a good point. Yeah, for sure. There'll be good companies coming out. One thing you said that piqued my interest was you were working with people like trauma from therapy. Could you speak to that a little bit more?
Yeah. Is it something that's a little bit unfamiliar to you, that there's a huge number of people who have been traumatized by psychotherapists? And the way I can tell you that it, you can look at your magazine, you know, the MFT magazine that comes out.
Yeah.
I forgot what it's called. I'm not a psychologist, so I don't have that magazine. But in that particular magazine, I forgot what it's called. At the back, there's all these like pages of people who have had their license removed or you know what I'm referring to? It's kind of like, it's like a professional obituary in a way. It's a,
the part that's surprising to me is I, of course, know that that can happen, but I don't know how common it is. I guess I imagine it being a pretty rare thing.
It's not rare. I mean, I don't think I have the statistics for you. There's many books been written about it, but let's just say that there is a variety of ways in which people have been harmed in the mental health system. A variety of ways. I won't enumerate all the ways, but they have to do with everything from what happens to people when they're inpatient psych, to what happens with bad therapists or exploitive therapists or therapists who are violating boundaries for sexual, economic, or narcissistic gain over their clients. And so there's a whole population of people who have been harmed by psychotherapy. And because of that, I always teach people when they're doing their intake, and some of them are afraid to speak because they're afraid that therapists won't believe them, or they're afraid that therapists will take a bias to defend their own against a patient's complaint. Or they have so much shame that they have let this, you know, maybe survivors of therapy trauma believe that they caused it or they should have known better or something like that. So there's many reasons why, but there's a huge swath of people who've been harmed in a variety of ways by therapists, often through sexual boundary violations.
It's terrible. Yeah. I mean, I've certainly worked with a number of people who had a negative impact from being hospitalized, right, against their will, or the 72-hour hold, or all that kind of thing.
And I've also worked with a large number of people who've been raped in inpatient hospitals by orderlies and other people. So there's also sexual boundary violations that happen in inpatient psych when people have very little, but also just regular outpatient psychotherapy. If you read about it and study about it, there's a lot of people who have survived a massive inappropriate therapeutic behavior. And so, you know, one of the reasons, you know, one of my main sort of contribution, small though it is, into the field is to teach people about countertransference awareness, countertransference sensitivity, how the therapist needs to understand all the intense feelings that come up in them in the work when psychedelics are added to the mix, so that the crimes already going on or the misdeeds already going on in all the fields of psychotherapy, psychology, psychiatry, everything from misdiagnosis, mismanagement, misuse of power, sexual violation, boundary violations, economic exploitation, all these things are potentially going to be amplified by psychedelics, because psychedelics are non-specific amplifiers, right?
Yes.
So we know that psychedelics, so if something already is going on and it's amplified with therapists not being trained from early on to be aware of all the intense emotions that come up, positive and negative, with our patients in these fields, then I'm hoping that if that gets built into a psychedelic psychotherapy training from the beginning, we'll have less likely malfeasance and mistakes and errors made that really destroy patients' lives. Because to tell you the truth, working with patients who've had therapy trauma on top of family trauma or other trauma, it extends the therapy so long and makes it really difficult to recover. Because the betrayal, it's like all the people have been betrayed by priests and people in the clergy, like that, the hundreds of thousands of people who've had that, right? When your betrayal takes place in the context of people who are trying to help you, right? It's a different kind of trauma than when it takes place in another context, because you're supposed to be able to trust the person and make yourself vulnerable to the person who's helping you. And if that person then, for any of a variety of reasons, exploits you, harms you, violates you, uses you in one way or another.
Yeah, it's such a betrayal of trust.
Yeah. On top of the other trauma, it makes it really hard for people to recover. So I'm really hoping that the psychedelic movement, because there's already been, public, you probably already know, there's been a public exposure of violations in the psychotherapy space.
I've heard about that, yeah.
And in the underground, both. So it's already happening. And so we really want to be mindful and training therapists to be aware of what are the things that make this likely to happen.
Yeah, it's super important, especially for everyone who's inspired with activism in this space or healing or therapists, like really be careful, because, I think there's the potential for, I mean, obviously you don't want that happening anyway, but because it's such a new thing, just becoming legalized, like we don't want some big scandal to taint the whole thing and to take away from the potential for healing that's there. And I think it's worth, really, we need to be careful. I know that I've heard people talk about it. We've talked about it some on this podcast, but it's good to just, like, of course, ethics. And I mean, ideally, it becoming legalized and all the licensure and all the, like even that magazine you mentioned, all those like checks and balances, safeguards, ways to prevent this from happening. Or if it happens, because we're human and things happen, like to treat it and to stop it and to, before it gets any worse.
And to have systems of repair and systems of accountability, and maybe spaces where we're wise enough now to know that this is going to happen because it's already happened, and that we have forums where patients can go to share their story behind, in front of a group of colleagues, and where the person who is the accused therapist, because not all therapists are guilty of what they're accused of. Let's say there's also some malicious, there has also been malicious lawsuits against therapists that are not valid. So I want to cover both sides of that equation, but that we create kind of not exactly tribunals or courts, but kind of professional committees that are really trained in this particular area of boundaries and ethics and the possibilities for a violation, and that both therapists and patients can trust that they can come into this forum and have meetings where this material is looked at, and maybe agreements about how the healing needs to happen, including for therapists being sent back for training or for mandatory therapy or mandatory revoking of their license for a period of time or forever if the boundary violations were significant enough. And also and I have had some colleagues who've been falsely accused by patients as well, if there's a forum where the trained professionals know about the potential for false accusations as well, that we get really sophisticated about having spaces where this stuff can get worked out, because the whole field could be completely interrupted by a bunch of scandals that happened in the first 5 years after.
Right. That's what I'm trying to, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I have a colleague who was, I believe, falsely accused by a client of theirs, and they went through a whole process with DORA, the Department of Regulatory Agencies, and they had this whole process around it, and they were exonerated. And it seemed like it worked well because that particular person crossed boundaries and like even went to their parents' home in a different state, you know, in there to try to complain about them. And it clearly had their own mental health issues and was just getting very vindictive. And but they were spreading it online, which is part of our world today, which can be so hard. So there were these posts online by this disgruntled person, and you know, so it was hard situation to go through.
Exactly. So I guess what we're saying is therapists need to be protected and patients need to be protected. And the history of this needs to be understood and known. And there needs to be a really educated committee created who are fluent in all of this literature and fluent in all of this, the potentials, and that we really create a safe space for that. We all know that there is a space to go to with very trained colleagues and patients' rights advocates alike to mediate these really sometimes very confusing situations. You know, sometimes it's very black and white. You know, people have been really exploitative, and other times it's much more nuanced and subtle. And you know, we need to mature as a field to create these spaces for healing. You know, if we're going to add psychedelic substances to our armamentarium, and we've already not handled things well before in terms of these problems, then we should really wise up and make sure that as the field matures, we don't just worry about, you know, the economics and access. We also worry about the possible ill effects to both therapists and patients, and do our best to create, you know, really good training, really, really solid training around these issues, ethics and countertransference and boundaries, and therapists learning what can come up for them and how to get consultation and how to be part of a network of support. Because one thing I really believe, and I'm sure you would agree, is that nobody should do this work alone. And everybody should be embedded in a series of supportive consultative relationships. And every patient coming to any one of us should know that their therapist has either a therapist or a consultant and a group that they go to, that we're all held. Like, those of us who are holding space are held well by others.
Yeah. You know,
being held while holding is what I call it. And that's something I think we have to mature as a field to make sure that no lone wolves are out there doing this work. It's not the kind of work that should be done alone. And just remembering, in indigenous cultures, as best as I understand it, this work is always held in community. And the context of the healing, even if there's a shaman working with an individual, there's usually the community around it that's involved in knowing about the healing and participating. There's safeguards that, you know, in our world, everything is so isolated in little private practices and little bubbles, that the psychedelic world cannot flourish that way. It needs to be, you know, intersecting communities of support and mature ethical awareness.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so many good points. One thing it brought up for me, and we don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but my graduate school did a really good job of emphasizing ethics and boundaries, but it was kind of like, there was kind of a fear, you know, so I kind of graduated with this fear, like, be very careful. And I think there can be a lot of value in therapeutic touch, and yet I feel a lot of hesitation myself because I don't want there to be a boundary issue. But I think, you know, I don't know if you have anything to speak to that. Like, I think in the MAPS thing, like placing a hand on the shoulder or just even holding hands, like in the session, can bring up a lot for people. And obviously the fear there is that there are therapists in the past or out there who have had violations, they've violated boundaries, who have touched it in an inappropriate way. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me give you a little bit of a wrap on this topic. It's one of my not favorite topics, because it's really disturbing, but one of the most important topics to talk about, right? Let's say in the past, there's been like two like bookend problems, right? One is that there was so much random violations that went on even during Sigmund Freud's era, right? People were having sex with their clients and all kinds of things that were never, you know, documented. And on the other end is that people became so frightened of any kind of boundary violation that, you know, even offering a patient a tissue or hugging them or shaking their hand became this huge anxiety thing, right? So that's like what happened in the history of psychotherapy. Now we have psychedelic psychotherapy coming in, and the issue of touch is very important in psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, as we teach it. Like, we teach this both at MAPS and through Polaris. You know, there's three types of touch, to be really simple, right? There's safety touch, there's supportive touch and there's therapeutic touch. And I can talk about each of those touches in a second, but there's no way not to have touch in psychedelic assisted therapy. I always say, we always say jokingly and playfully, safety touch is mandatory because we have to have people, you know, not fall off the bed. We have to help people to the bathroom, or there's certain basic elements of touch that do not exist in regular psychotherapy. So everybody who's training to become a psychedelic therapist must be trained in the ethics and awareness about touch and of these three types of touch. Now, the first type of touch is not negotiable. If you came into me and said, I don't want to be touched at all, then I'm saying, like, we can't work with you. Because we might have to help you not fall off the bed. We might have to help you keep safe if you're flailing around. And we might have to help you get to the bathroom. And even if you've had a lot of... So that's one type of touch that's mandatory. So everybody has to be trained in safety touch. And then there's something called supportive touch, which is, you know, holding your hand, putting a hand on a shoulder, you know, various forms of helping people stay with their process. And of course, every patient can refuse that and decide not to have that. And there's many, many books and things written about negotiating touch and whether people can change their mind once they're in an altered or non-altered state of consciousness, which we mostly agreed in our field, they cannot change their mind in the middle of a session. If they said, don't ever hold my hand during the intake and prep, and then all of a sudden in the middle of a psychedelic session, they say, yes, I want you to hold my hand, we can't really do it. Mm. So we have to review that again in the next session, say, okay, maybe in the next session we can, but we can't do anything you have not agreed to. But safety touch is something they can't disagree to.
Hmm. Good.
Supportive touch, they can say yes or no about. And then therapeutic touch is more complicated. That involves, like, you know, pushing and kicking and screaming and using various forms of touch to help people do release work. And that should only be done by people who have some training in it. But we always introduce, there's three types of touch in all the intakes and prep work we do with ketamine and with MDMA, and hopefully they're doing it with psilocybin, and that, you know, these can all be optional except safety touch. And that means that people have to unlearn all of their inhibitions around touch coming from regular psychotherapy, coming into psychedelic therapy training. And we all spend quite a bit of time, both in the MAPS protocol of training and in Polaris, teaching people about not only about the different types of touch, but what does that bring up for you? You know, how is it for you to know that you're going to have to do some kind of hands-on work? Or how does it feel that you've been told for 20 years, don't ever hold a patient's hand. Mm. And now you're going to be maybe holding their hand as part of a process and learning when not to hold their hand and learning all the subtleties about how touch can be an intrusion or about how touch can be a facilitating part of the process and how your own anxieties about touch or your own feelings about it. So it's such a complicated area that I'm excited about is now included in the curriculum. Because in regular psychotherapy, it's easy to say, no, no touch. But in psychedelic assisted therapy, if we say that, we're really depriving the therapeutic relationship of a number of really important elements that can make a huge difference.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's great to share and think about and have here. And I think it's, yeah, again, evolving. It makes so much sense. I like that. I haven't heard those three types of touch before exactly, but I really like that. Let's see. I wanted to ask you while I have you, and I realize we don't have a ton of time, but you said you also have specialized in dissociative identity disorder.
Yeah, I have many, many decades of specializing in the treatment of survivors of extreme abuse, which usually ends up categorized under one of the diagnoses of either complex PTSD or dissociative identity disorder or some of the dissociative disorders.
Mm. And I mean, disassociation, it's such a tricky thing in my experience to work with and track. And I think, like a lot of these things we're talking about, it's on a spectrum. So someone with extreme trauma, you know, is going to be different, but that we all have, you know, times where we disassociate. And do you have any, just thoughts, reflections to share about that and how therapy can help, how psychedelic therapy could help with that? I mean, with some, like ketamine, for example, classically was called a disassociative. So it's surprising to people to learn that it could help them associate to their body.
Exactly. One of the great paradoxes of ketamine is it's a dissociative that can help you reassociate. But I mean, you know, it's funny when somebody like you asks me a question like this, and it happens sometimes in training, I almost feel like I'm the wrong person to ask because I have an encyclopedia in my head about dissociative because I've studied it my whole life. Mm-hmm. And so how do I take an ocean of a question and put it into a little bit of a thimble answer? But the best I'll try to do it for a couple of minutes is just to say, you know, in general, dissociation is a, you know, whether you want to call it, you know, God-given or biologically given or both, capacity of the human psyche that serves so many functions, from, you know, from survival through extreme torture and trauma, to also kind of creativity, spiritual work, transformation, and, you know, everything from daydreaming and, you know, coming up with solutions from daydreaming, or art and poetry are sometimes written in dissociative states. So states of mind that are, you know, loosened up from the hyper compartmentalization of normal life. And, you know, so we're continuing from daydreaming on one end to like polyfragmented dissociative identity disorder on the other end, where we have 100 different personalities with 100 different names doing 100 different things who don't know about each other. And so we have this kind of capacity of mind. And then we have this idea of a compartmentalization, right? Because you can have dissociation without hyper compartmentalization. And so, you know, like a lot of people who are trans channelers in Brazil who practice Spiritismo, which is a religion, are, you know, they're good at dissociating from the rigidity of the human form, and then they can kind of go into trance and bring messages back for their community from a spiritual nature. So we have these beautiful spiritually positive meanings of the word dissociation. And then we have this kind of confusion about the word because it's used in so many kinds. And then we have severe trauma-based dissociation, which is, you know, the human psyche's adaptation to trauma, which is being overwhelmed and then compartmentalizing parts of the experience so that you're not completely obliterated by the experiences. So the human capacity disconnects and then compartmentalizes, you know, the emotion, the meaning, the somatics into different places of the psyche, until which time they can sometimes be brought back together or not. And so we have this huge continuum of dissociation, right? So that's the general idea, right? From like, very, and then we have psychedelic induced dissociation, which confuses everyone even more, right? Because it's a different type of dissociation, even if it uses the same principle the psyche has to disconnect. So just to be really simple, right? With ketamine, there's two types of dissociation. Since you're familiar with ketamine, I'll use just ketamine for now, right? So low dose ketamine, psycholytic dose ketamine, helps people dissociate. So this is benevolent dissociation, right? And chosen, but it's not a traumatic based dissociation that's happening as survival. It's like you choose to take this medicine in order to work on something. And in a low dose, all of a sudden you're dissociated from your ruminative mind, your obsessions, you're no longer merged with. So you're disconnected from old belief patterns, old ideas, and you're loose, and you can observe them. And not you're no longer merged with them, or you're unblended, to use a term from ACT, right? So you're unblended, and you're dissociated in this benevolent way from all the rigidities of your personality. And because of that, you can do all this work. You're sort of in a trance state, which EMDR can do as well as other, you know, shamanic drumming. And then we have psychedelic-based dissociation. You still with me on this?
Yeah, so
it's easy to talk about psychedelic. So psychedelic dissociation is you're no longer connected to yourself as a biographical entity limited by the name Julian Royce. So Julian is now a particle of infinite consciousness surfing the field of consciousness, having a journey and going wherever you're going to go. But Julian is no longer just Julian. Julian is part of everything, part of this. Julian made me talk. So you're now dissociated from the limitation of your biographical identity. And so that's another form of dissociation associated with psychedelic dosing. And so we have this word dissociation that means all these different things depending on the context. And some of it is survival-based, some of it's creativity-based, some of it's spiritual-based. And with these chemicals, these sacraments, it's actually a benevolent reliever of constriction and limitation and, you know, helps us unmerge from limited states of identity, belief, and consciousness. So Julian will realize on a psychedelic journey, he's so much more than Julian Royce. Julian has contacted three ancestors, four previous lifetimes. He was a redwood tree. He, you know, realized that any limited thought of who he was is now a joke. And he's expanded his consciousness beyond any limited. You've dissociated from the what I call DNA skin suit of Julian Royce. And then you come back into Julian from having been everything. And that's a form of psychedelic dissociation that's so beneficial and transformative. So that same word, dissociation.
I love that. So yeah, the same word, big spectrum, like you said, and it was so helpful to hear you articulate different types, even daydreaming. That's like, of course, a kind of disassociation, and tends to have such a negative connotation, I think, especially in somatic therapy. You know, it's all about, we want to be in our body. We want to be spiritual teachings. We always be present, be here now, and to actually honor the spectrum of experience. And it's not necessarily negative or positive. It could, you know, obviously it could be a trauma symptom, but it could be, like you just said, it could be an amazing experience. It could be a spiritual experience. It could be expanding your identity.
How about if I say something even more radical than what you said, which is it's always positive. Okay. What I mean by that, because it's been misunderstood, it's been degraded, it's misunderstood, but that everybody who's using dissociation for whatever reason should be respected in the moment, or for the fact that they've used dissociation to survive or cope. And so let's say you're in a bodywork session and you're dissociating. And then you feel now ashamed that you're dissociating, right? Because you're not supposed to be dissociating. You're supposed to be present. And now you feel shamed either by yourself or by the culture or by the training program or by the therapist. Like, why aren't you being present? You're dissociating. But what if there's always a meaning to the exploration of why somebody's dissociating, and that there's value in it and something to be explored? And if you shame it or pathologize it, not only is everybody going to feel worse who is doing it, but we're going to lose respect for a beautiful defense that's been there for a reason, usually for psychological survival, usually for protection against horrific, overwhelming experience, or in the positive sense, for creativity or spiritual connection. Or in that moment, maybe you're not feeling safe. Maybe you can't be present because you don't feel safe. And why can't we explore the unsafety you're feeling without pathologizing dissociation? Why can't we honor, like, maybe there's something okay about feeling unsafe in this moment to be present? And so in that way, I would say all dissociation should be called depathologized, should be respected and honored, and become something that we respect and explore and not ever judge as inappropriate, even though it causes a lot of problems for people who do it all the time.
Yeah, that's well said. That's so, it brings to mind, I haven't experienced this from a therapist that I'm remembering, to their credit, but I was in a coaching program, and it was definitely had like cult-like dynamics, or some people called it a cult in retrospect. But I remember getting this coaching session, and they would do it in front of the big group of people, which was part of what wasn't always helpful in their approach and probably damaging to a lot of people. But then they would say, like, oh, where did you go? And the disassociation, they were good at noticing it, naming it, but it was definitely shamed, and it was the opposite of what you're sharing. So it's good to hear that. And that's a beautiful approach to share, to not shame it, and it's not negative, and it's happening for a reason. I think there's really something there. Yeah.
I think we need to really reframe our complete understanding of dissociation at every level. And it's one of my other many missions in the field as a teacher.
Interesting. That's a great thing to share about. And yeah, I think a lot of well-meaning teachings, perspectives, practices, spiritual teachings, be here now, that kind of thing, like, of course it's helpful, but then it can become kind of rigid and kind of used to shame something. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. One of my favorite slides in one of the trainings I do for Polaris is Dharma, not dogma. Meaning, like, as we develop the psychedelic field, as we really move into a later mature phase, let's make sure we don't become dogmatic. Let's keep adding to the Dharma. Let's keep adding to what we know. And our main teachers are always our patients or our clients. Let's never forget that. And let's keep adding to what we're learning and never become too much like tribalist, like EMDR therapists or DBT therapists or a psychoanalyst, that our field is so balkanized and so divided historically, and people think they know the right way to do things. And I hope that the psychedelic movement, as it matures, can really become a space of cross-fertilization, cross-pollinization, non-rigidity. And so I always say Dharma, not dogma. Evolving the Dharma of psychedelic therapy. 100 years from now, they'll benefit from all the things that we're learning, and it'll stay open, and it will not become like, this is the only way to do it.
Yeah. The field of therapy is super balkanized, and I've complained about that. And it's partly economic reasons, where if I develop my own little thing and trademark it, and everyone's doing that, so then there's a million different specialties and a million different modalities, and
It's partly that, but it's also like I was a little kid growing up in New York City, right? And there were two teams, the Mets and the Yankees, and you had to like one or the other. And I was a Mets fan. My whole family was a Mets fan, and we really didn't like people who were Yankee fans. And so I just think there's something in human nature, unfortunately, mm-hmm. something tribalistic, where we want a team to root for. And so, yes, there's economic reasons, and people put a lot of years into study to become a psychoanalyst or a Jungian analyst. And so they are affiliated with that worldview. So, but I think there's something that's not so great in human nature that makes us want to like pick a side, pick a team, root for something, cheer for something against something else. And I think that's wired into us, unfortunately. And so it's all also goes back to that, you know.
I think we're evolved and wired to be tribalist. And to go back to that book, The Status Game, he shares a psychological study where they took a bunch of people in a big room, and then they talked to him for a little bit, and then they said, we're going to divide you up into two teams, and we're going to flip a coin here. You're going to either be team, heads or tails. And then they would do that, and they kept them, once they had separated them for a little bit, then they would go and talk to each team, and they say, so what do you think about team red over there? And the blue team would be like, they're not as smart as us. They're not quite as good looking. And they knew, they had just witnessed the coin flip, so they knew it was completely arbitrary. And yet that dynamic still started to happen minutes after they were divided up.
Right. And of course, the more extreme versions of this research, right? The Stanford prison
experiment. Right.
Where you're going to be the prisoner, I'm going to be the guard, and then we're going to play this game. And so all the social psychology research also showed that this particular, I would say flaw in human nature can be really exacerbated into some really awful things, as we know in world history. We go from like, I like the Mets and I don't like the Yankees, to, CBT therapy is better than Jungian therapy, to like, one race is better than the other race, to the United States is the best country. We get into these extreme, and I'm really hoping, I think my big prayer really, especially as coming into my elder years, is that the psychedelic movement becomes a movement of increasing fluid dharma, not dogma, and constantly being taught by our patients what works, what doesn't work, and that we get together and we're constantly growing and being surprised and learning something new, and that we keep our humility and our innocence always handy, and that we're always learning something new, and that we never think we've nailed it, we never think we figured it all out, and that we're an evolving body of wisdom and knowledge into the future. That's my wish for the psychedelic movement.
Beautiful. I love that. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. Do you have any last words for us?
My last words, believe it or not. So I think my last word, it's good for me to end on the note of my prayer for the psychedelic world, but I want to just check in with you and how you're doing about what we talked about, because we didn't know what we were going to talk about. And I am concerned a little bit that we ended up in a more shadow territory than I had planned or you planned. And I just want to see how it's affected you, how our talk has affected you.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I think this was really good. And I think it's good for me on a personal level. And I think it'll be good for the listeners, and just in terms of the arc of the podcast, for what it's worth, to bring more of that voice in is actually really needed. And I hadn't been thinking that or as aware of that as I should have been. I have had some activists and some people of color in the podcast, but I could do a lot more. But to really speak to those shadow sides in the way you did felt really touching. And hearing you talk about disassociation, like, I'm going to actually listen to that section again, because that is something that I want to understand better. And I appreciated the way you shared about that.
So you're not unduly stressed by our conversation?
I'm not unduly stressed. I am humbled, and sometimes feels like damned if you do, damned if you don't. I think like a lot of people in the world, mental health and therapy, coming from a place of wanting to help people, wanting to be of service, and then running into all the economic pressures and the status games, and recognizing that's true for me too, and I wouldn't be honest if I said it wasn't. And so to try to, maybe there's a way to make these things more conscious and play with them in a way that they can be in alignment with helping the greater good. That's my hope. But I think it's good to just...
I like what you just said. How to make them in alignment with the greater good. Like, knowing we have these propensities, we have these tendencies as human beings, how do we make them work for the greater good?
Because we're not going to get rid of them,
And I don't think so. Yeah. We're monkeys. We have the DNA of a primate. So
yeah. There's this phrase that I love that rattles around in my head of we're just bipedal great apes wandering around, and I'll think that when I'm like out and about. It's like, it's true. It's just we're big apes and we walk on 2 feet, but we're still animals. And I think I have a lot of background with Buddhism, and there's problems everywhere you look, but there is ways in which we can leverage these things to the greater good. Like, you know, if you're in a meditative community, there's some status. Oh, that person has done 4 years of retreat. That person's done 3 years of retreat. And that can become its own problem. But in theory, if retreat is a good thing, then you know, they're being motivated by that status game in a good way, perhaps. So.
Exactly. And I do think, you know, of all the systems, all the religious systems in the world try to address the issue of virtue and what's the opposite of virtue? Virtue and...
We don't want to say sin.
Error. Let's just say virtue and error. Virtue and dysfunctional pattern. There's a word. I can't think of what it is in Buddhism particularly. But I feel like the Buddhist tradition has really attempted to include the shadow in a really, especially Tibetan Buddhism, in a really beautiful way, making room for it, including it, narrating it, and not vilifying or demonizing it, but making it known that if you're going to have a healthy spirituality, you have to have a relationship with the light and the shadow and be in constant dialogue within yourself and within the community about how those two things are possibly falling out of alignment, out of balance, because one can really fertilize the other. And when they come into new forms of intersection, there's great art, usually great art and great breakthroughs that come from that, you know? So I hope also that the psychedelic world will benefit from, you know, a mature relationship with shadow and light.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the other thing I'm reflecting on from our conversation is there's this famous quote from Thich Nhat Hanh that the future Buddha will be the Sangha, will be the community.
Yes.
The value of community, because that's the only way to balance this stuff out. If it's a very cult of personality, it's going to eventually blow up or lead to a lot of trauma or abuse, right? So we have to have a community to hold it.
Exactly. That's one of my favorite sayings of his, by the way. And so we can even say that this podcast and you and I are in our two-person Sangha. Right. Regardless of the age difference between us, or regardless of like, I have more experience in some things than you do, and you have more experience than I do, that we're equal. And that the future Sangha is a bunch of people who are equal ascending into collective consciousness and healing together without pathological hierarchy and without particular experiences being used for power over the other.
That's beautiful. That's a good vision for the future. Yeah.
So thank you for inviting me. I don't do very many podcasts, believe it or not.
And thank you. I'm glad I persevered.
Let's do this again sometime.
Okay. Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks so much for being on it.
Thank you. And after it's over, whatever, wherever it is, we have a monthly newsletter, which you should subscribe to, called the Polaris Pulse, which is a monthly newsletter from our clinic, and we have poems in it and other things. And I would love for the podcast to be linked there so people could listen to this. And we have thousands of people who receive our, and I would love for your work to be, because I've heard some of your podcasts and I really like them. Somehow, if there's a way you'd send me the link, I'll send it to our team and they'll put it on the next Polaris Pulse. And however we decide to title this, and then that'll also serve your work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I'll link stuff in the show notes with the episode. And yeah, we'll definitely do that.
Yeah, it must be an easy way. Like you'd send me something, and I could just send it on to them, and they could, right? One of those live link things, right?
Yeah.
You're good. So make sure you do that. And many blessings on your work. Till we meet again.
Thank you.